Coffee with Cudmore.
Light 104.7 and 1570 AM WVTL.
We welcome Diane Carey to the program. Good morning, Diane.
Good morning, Mr. Bob. How are you?
Doing quite well. Diane Carey's a best-selling author. We're going to talk with her about a couple of books. She has other interests. I think she's a witch, among other things, and a psychic. But I'm really interested in the best-selling part. Before we launch into a specific book, you've had a number of books published that have sold a lot of copies. How do you do that?
Well, I started quite a long time ago. I've been writing for about, well, I've been published for about 35 years. I started when I was 15. And it's been a long road of learning and rejection and rewriting. That's probably the thing that got me ahead the most, was revising my own work and just learning by doing that and having people read it and going back and making more changes. If you're not willing to make changes in your own work, your chances of being published are fairly slim,
because
that means you won't be learning.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. It's kind of like the modern wikis, you know, where you get help from other people because they say, oh, I don't like that, or I do like that, and so forth.
Right, and it pays to listen. You don't have to make changes, but it pays to pay attention to why people are making the comments they're making. And that was, I was in a writer's club, and we used to read each other's work and make comments. It was very valuable.
Mm-hmm. And you've done a number of Star Trek books through the years, correct?
Yes, I was Star Trek's top-selling author, and we had a very remarkable relationship for 15 years with Pocket Books. Very good marketing relationship. We launched lots of ships in the pages of our books and explained a lot of the history of characters, like James Kirk's first mission in space at 16 years old. That book was a top 15 hardcover New York Times bestseller. So it went over. As a matter of fact, they based the first new movie with Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto on the plot of that book, it was inspired by that book. So I was really proud. They even said so. So, yep, lots of Star Trek history. I've written a series of 7 books about emergency rescue with teenagers and police work and that sort of thing, and a couple of nonfiction books, and now Banners.
Mm-hmm. And Banners is a work of historical fiction, correct, about set in the War of 1812.
It is. I felt very compelled to write this. I'm actually a member of the crew, a volunteer crew for the Pride of Baltimore, which is a sailing ship out in Baltimore that actually has come up over the St. Lawrence Seaway to Michigan several times. I'm in Michigan. And I sail tall ships, so just as an aside, I have a ship on the Hudson called Half Moon, so I've been up and down the Hudson many, many times, and your part of New York doesn't get a lot of press, but it is gorgeous and loaded with history.
Well, I mean, I remember the Half Moon, a replica of the Half Moon coming up to Albany and so on and so forth. Is that the ship you mean?
Oh, that's the ship.
Okay.
Yeah, that's my ship.
Your ship? You own it?
Well, I call them all my ships.
I see.
You know, but I've been sailing Half Moon for many years.
Right.
Captain Reynolds and I go back a long, long time. As a matter of fact, when he first took over command of the ship, I was his first watch leader, which means I was in charge of making sure the crew is trained and operational and they're in the right places and that they're safe. So now I do that on many ships, and I always try to go back to Half Moon just to keep my toe in it once in a while.
Do you know when Half Moon will be coming this way again? This way would be Albany, probably.
You know, I think she's on her way to Albany pretty much right now. I know that they're rigging up and getting ready to go. The weather might have slowed them down a little bit. They winter in Verplank, which is a little teeny tiny speck of a town where we have a nice protected little dock. And she stays there, and they work on her all year, and I work on her when I get up there. And so I've taken the train and the ship up and down the Hudson many, many times. It's a beautiful, beautiful place.
Is Verplank in New York as well? I mean, or is it just down the
Hudson? Yeah, it's right there in the Hudson. I think it's about an hour or two from Albany by ship.
Hmm. The current book, as you said, is Banners, and it's set in Baltimore and has something to do with the Star Spangled Banner, and that's about what I know about it.
It does. Well, I felt compelled to write the story of the privateers and about Francis Scott Key, because even though he's a household name, hardly anybody knows anything about him. What was he doing there? Why was he witnessing the battle? Why was he inspired to write this particular battle song when he was, in fact, a pacifist and not involved really at all? He didn't want to be involved. He disapproved of the war strongly. And by the time he was on the British fleet there trying to free another American who'd been captured, he ended up having to stay and watching the battle at Fort McHenry. And I have been shocked in my time how many people think that that was during the Revolutionary War, and they think that Betsy Ross made that flag.
My son lives in Baltimore, so we went down to the, I don't know who, I can't think of her name, but I mean, they have an historic house, I guess, where the woman lived and who made this huge flag. I mean, it was a big flag.
This flag was 42 feet by 30 feet. It was as big as Mary Pickersgill's house. She had to take the flag with, something like 1,200 feet of English bunting. She had to take it to a brewery and lay it out there because there was no room in her house to lay this thing out. The stars are 2 feet wide, and it was a remarkable feat of 350,000 hand stitches at that time. And we forget that flags were very important throughout history. For until the modern age, they were really the only way to communicate over distance. And the commander of Fort McHenry wanted the British to be able to see his fort from way off, 2 miles, which was where they were. And so he ordered this gigantic flag, and the whole fort is, you could throw a baseball across the whole thing, it's very small. But he knew that Baltimore was going to be a key target, and the British had burned Washington, and he knew they were going to come to Baltimore, and he had that flag made. And Mary Pickersgill made and delivered that flag in 6 weeks, and it is enormous, and that's the Star Spangled Banner. It's a 15-star, 15-stripe flag, and it's now at the Smithsonian, what's left of it.
Why did he want to draw attention to his fort?
He wanted to be defiant. He wanted to tell the British and everybody that that Fort McHenry had not folded. And in fact, he did that. They managed to hold off the British all night and not let them pass the bottleneck that led to Baltimore's inner harbor, which was where the privateer ships were being built at Fells Point. The privateer ships were, you know, when we went to war in 1812, we only had 6 battleships. We had 6 frigates. The English Royal Navy had 900 ships of war. So it was kind of a lopsided battle. And President Madison solved part of this problem by hiring private captains or giving them permission to go out and raid English shipping. And they did it so well that we actually won the war at sea, even though we lost on land. And we darn near lost the country. People don't realize the importance of the War of 1812, and we don't know. I think we're forgetting. Our children are not being taught why America is exceptional and why we are a beacon of freedom around the world and what makes us that way. And there are reasons we're that way, and there are reasons that we fought for our country. And in 1812, we became a world power taken seriously in the world. Before that, we were just a bunch of little silly states trying to be something. The world really didn't take us seriously, and we were being stopped from trading, which was hurting our economy, and we sort of wanted to stand up in the world and be a country, and the War of 1812 was when that happened.
Mm-hmm. And the banners, the novel, I mean, you depict Francis Scott Key, and again, you've said it 100 times now, with the woman who designed the flag, or there are other, and then there are probably other characters in this book as well.
The three main characters, the three stories I concentrated on were Francis Scott Key and how he came to be there and what his attitude was and who he was, his family, his purpose in life. He couldn't make a decision between being a lawyer and being a minister. He was a very mild, quiet young man who was wealthy and famous in his own time. Mary Pickersgill, the lady who made the flag, running a business of her own. She was a widow, as so many women outlived their husbands at that time and through history, that they had to make their own ways in the world, and she was running this flag business, very important to the merchant fleet. And the third part of the story is about Captain Tom Boyle, who is the captain of a ship called the Chasseur, one of the privateers. And Captain Boyle exemplified American spunky nature by taking his ship. When he got fed up with the United States being blockaded by England, he took his ship over to England, sent some people to on land with a note and stapled the note on Lloyd's of London's front door and said, "You are now under blockade by the United States."
I see.
One ship.
Mm-hmm. The one ship blockade.
One ship.
Banners.
Go ahead. He helped to make our our American reputation, the way the world thought about us.
Banners by Diane Carey. It's out now. It's an historic novel. Something really completely different. You also have a book out now called How to Help Stray Pets and Not Get Stuck. How did you get interested in this field?
Yeah, I do. Let me say that Banners is not out until August, but it's available for pre-order now, which is a real good idea. You can get it on Amazon or almost any other book site. My website is DianeCareyAuthor.com, DianeCarey Author, and you can find out everything you want to know there. How to Help Stray Pets and Not Get Stuck is my first self-help book, my only self-help book, and it is the result of 34 years and 400 dogs and cats coming in and out of my house. I never set out to be an animal rescue, and I didn't really want to do it, and I still don't want to do it, but these animals seem to come my way, and I just learned how to take charge and how to find them new homes. It's very important that if you're going to have a big heart and take in stray pets, that you learn how to find them new permanent homes that are well matched to the animal, or you stand the risk of becoming a pet hoarder with 5 and 6 and 10 and 30 animals that will ruin your finances and your family and your life. Very important not to do that.
Well, that's interesting you bring that up, because I mean, they're not countless, but we frequently have news stories about that very thing you just described. You know, the pet hoarders, I mean, it seems like the outcome's often the same. They say, well, you know, it's really a good-hearted person, but they just took in all these animals. They just couldn't handle them. That's all they, you know, it overwhelmed them.
It does overwhelm them, and without the skills to cycle these animals to new homes, it really does destroy people's lives. It'll literally ruin the home you're living in. Your family will not want to come around anymore. The place is unhealthy. It's a public health risk. It's a personal health risk. There's every reason not to do it, and yet these people don't know what to do, and they can't stand to leave these little animals out on the streets. We need more people trained to take animals off the streets, and yet also keep your home clean and find the right new home for these pets, because it's not good for the pets to be in this environment either. So they're not really doing anybody any favors. They just can't say no. So I wrote this book to help people learn how to do that. There's a method. I have a way to do it. It's step to step. It's really easy. You just have to steel yourself, learn how to do it, and then get the gumption to do it. And part of the reason that I wrote the book is it can be so empowering to teach yourself to take charge of a situation, even if it's just a kitten. It'll make you feel more empowered. I like that word because it's true. It makes you learn how to take charge. You learn how to not pass a problem along and not keep a problem. And it can really enhance your life if you do it right, whereas the other side, if you do it wrong, can destroy your life.
And you say the key is to find a way to pass the animals along or to get them to someone else who will care for them. And you have the method. But that is, I would seem to me that must be the issue, because, you know, if you were to ask me, gee, Bob, would you like to take a cat? No, I don't want to take a cat. You know, so how do you find people who would actually take the cat, I guess, is the question.
Well, I advertise for them just like anything else. I don't try to force these animals off on my family and friends. Sometimes that works, but rarely. But it just makes your friends not want to see you coming. I actually advertise. I have a way to write an ad. I use Craigslist and newspapers, local papers, and things like that. And it has always worked. There is a pet. There's a family out there for every animal. The key is to match them right, and you have to have the courage to say no. I don't think you're the right person for this pet, and that's hard. Mm-hmm. It's just a matter of learning how to do it and how to say it, and to be bold enough to say it. But one of the key questions I ask is, where have you had pets before, and where did they sleep? It's a key thing, because I believe that I know that dogs and cats all need to be inside with their people. They are animals that have been domesticated for a million years, and they're not suited to be outside. Even if they're suited physically to be outside, which usually in northern winters and summers they're not, they are not suited psychologically to be outside. It's not good to have an outside pet. They need company. They need companionship. And that makes a good, you know, animals have psyches and psychologies just the same as we do, at least higher animals like dogs and cats. And they can be bruised psychologically. They can get neurotic. They can get unsociable. They can be they can get to where they don't make good pets. They get lonely. They don't have good mental. They're not in good shape. You know, physical shape is one thing, mental is another. So they need to be inside. So I try to find families for these animals that will have them in the house. That takes a certain kind of person who can have an animal in the house and keep it clean and take care of it for 10, 12, 20 years. Mm-hmm. It's a commitment. I don't give my pets to anybody who's not willing to do that and doesn't completely understand it and lives in an apartment and might be, you know, a student or, you know, their situation could change in 2 years. I look for stable homes that have been there for a long time, people who've had animals before. And you can find these people. You just have to learn not to be desperate. Take your time. It can take time, and that's fine. And give them to the right home. Match the breed to the person. Sometimes animal breeds, sometimes animal personalities. You know, the longer you have them in your house, the more you get to know them, the more acclimated they get to being in a family, and they get better at it.
Mm-hmm.
So there are ways to find the right pet for your house. And I've had to, just in the last couple of months, I've had to find new homes for three animals that were not suited to their homes. They were nice animals, the homes were nice homes, but they just weren't suited. And you have to be able to find it. Yet you can't match a dog that needs a lot of energy with a young lady that has three kids and no time to give the dog exercise. So these are all considerations, and it's all addressed in the book, and it's an easy read, you know.
Diane Carey, I thank you very much for joining us. You're a very busy person. How to Help Stray Pets and Not Get Stuck is one book. I believe that one's out now, right?
That is out.
Okay.
Yes, it is.
And then Banners coming later this year, historical fiction about Frances Scott Key, the woman who made the big banner, and the war in 1812 and the role of privateers. Thank you very much.
Right. And remember that, Bob, this year is the 200th anniversary of the Star-Spangled Banner, both the flag and the song, born in 1814.
Well, thank you, Diane Carey. You have a good day.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Bob. Bye-bye. Hi, everybody.
9:22 the time, the morning show. We have news coming up at 9:30. Then we'll talk with another author, Bob MacPeak. His book is entitled The 85% Man and Lessons from Lucille. Later this hour, Tim Becker, owner of Anthem Websites, publisher of Mohawk Valley Compass, the online newspaper.
She's got a way.